Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today, the Congressional Budget Office updated its deficit projections for 2010, about $1.35 trillion. And that may help explain the latest budgetary trial balloon from the White House. If there is money in the federal budget that the president doesn't absolutely have to spend, well, then he just doesn't want to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 26th of January today, and it is great to have you here. Presidents before this one have tried to limit spending, and presidents after this one surely will as well. The catch is that there is only so much of the federal budget the chief executive has any control over. It falls into the category of what is called non-defense discretionary spending. Here to tell us what that means and how much money it might actually add up to is our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale. Hey, John.
Hello, Kai.
So non-defense discretionary spending is a very long phrase, but in the end, this does not amount to all that much of the budget, does it?
No, this is a cap on a small part of government spending, less than one-sixth of the overall budget. But it's very symbolic because it's the part that Congress has control over, that lobbyists fight over. Farm programs, education, environmental programs. The freeze would cut only $250 billion over 10 years, but that's out of a $3.5 trillion budget every year. I think it's more calibrated to respond to the message from voters in the last few special elections that Americans are really worried about the government spending money that it doesn't have.
Well, let me ask you a question on those along those lines, and this is going to get all macroeconomic on you here, but there's a lot of economic thought that says, listen, when the economy is rough, it's probably not the time to actually cut government spending. How does that fit into the general economic picture?
Well, that's the needle that the White House has to thread. In this economy, the government should be helping prime the pump, create or at least encourage jobs, but how to do that without building up debt for future generations. So the president says he's taking a scalpel rather than a hatchet to the budget. His freeze won't apply to the stimulus programs, which CBO said today is now going to cost over $850 billion because of the higher-than-expected demand for unemployment benefits and food stamps. Nor will it apply to middle-class programs that the Obama administration's been touting, or aid for states to keep local government employees on the job.
So politics not really very far from his mind, right?
Sure. A lot of this comes down to telling independent voters that the White House gets it. The time has come to rein in spending, get deficits under control. But remember, Congress has to go along here. And this being an election year, incumbents also want to bring home some bacon.
Frame this for me, John, in the context of the larger Obama agenda. He entered office with some things, you know, he was talking about doing. Where's the money going to come from if he's going to freeze his discretionary budget?
Right. The president knew this was coming, that the bill for the bailouts and the stimulus would come due and that he'd have to trim his agenda. I think his hope was that before this happened, the economy would have turned around and his reforms of healthcare and maybe the energy industries would have helped bring deficits down. But in the absence of that, it seems the president will now have to pursue fewer new government programs and instead spend more time burnishing his deficit-cutting credentials just to help Democrats in this year's congressional elections.
And we will hear more in the State of the Union tomorrow night, I'm sure, John. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale on the story for us. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
The Federal Reserve started one of its regular two-day meetings today. The mood in the boardroom at the Fed's building on Constitution Avenue is probably a little more tense than usual. There is still some degree of uncertainty about whether the Senate is going to give Ben Bernanke another term running the central bank. A vote on that, by the by, should happen by the end of the week. But politics aside, there is that little matter of interest rates. The Fed is expected to keep its federal funds rate right where it is, that is, low, for many months to come. But when the Fed does eventually decide to raise rates, it may have to find a new way to do it, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains now from New York.
The federal funds rate is what banks charge each other to borrow money overnight. The Fed sets a target rate and then buys or sells securities to bring the actual rate in line. Bruce McCain is chief investment strategist with Key Private Bank. He says it worked until Lehman Brothers collapsed and the Fed flooded the economy with cash.
We've had to go so far beyond merely changing interest rates to putting money into the system in ways that are truly outside the bounds of the normal interventions that the Federal Reserve has used in the past.
Because there's so much cash in the system now, buying or selling a few billion dollars worth of Treasury bonds barely moves the needle. Ray Stone is a managing director of Stone and McCarthy Research Associates. He says making the old system work now would require the Fed to scale back its balance sheet fast.
To do that, they would have to sell loads of assets, like mortgages, to the tune of $1 trillion or more. This is operationally pretty difficult.
So there's a new idea being floated. When the Fed wants to raise interest rates, it could start paying banks more to store their excess cash reserves.
So, for example, if the Fed wants to tighten to 1% from a quarter, they will raise the interest on bank reserves to 1%. With that, it's thought that the federal funds rate will rise in accordance with the interest rate paid on bank reserves.
Because presumably no bank would accept less interest for an overnight loan to another bank than it's getting to store its money at the Fed. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There was an automotive bright spot in the news today, a couple of them, actually. General Motors announced it has finally found a buyer for Saab. The Dutch sports car maker Spyker has stepped in to save the Swedish brand. And Ford said it's going to add 1,200 new jobs at an assembly plant in Chicago in the fourth quarter of this year. They will be Ford's first jobs since a 2007 agreement with United Auto Workers, a deal that lets the company bring on new workers for less. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more now on what could be the auto worker job of the future.
Ford doesn't know how many new workers it's going to hire yet. But when it does start hiring, it'll create a divide in its labor force. Laura Worley spent 14 years at Ford before she took a buyout. Now she's back at her old job, but as a contractor. And unlike her coworkers, if she doesn't work, she doesn't get paid.
Instead of all being the engine together that moves the same ship, now we have a little more distanced from each other in a way.
Ford's new employees will be in a similar situation, doing the same jobs, but for a lot less money. Sean McElinden is chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research. He says the UAW agreed to the new contract, though it breaks with a 70-year tradition of getting workers the same pay for the same work.
Even greater significance, instead of receiving a defined benefit pension, for all of their pension, they receive a 401k, and also their health plan has higher deductibles.
McElinden says the union realized health care and pension costs could put the big three out of business. Dale Bellman's a professor of labor relations at Michigan State. He says the new workers have to compare these jobs to what else is out there.
You're probably making three times what the guys in McDonald's are making. You've got benefits. You're doing a lot better than folks at Walmart.
Ford reports earnings on Thursday. Analysts expect the company to be profitable this year, a year ahead of the company's own predictions. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Speaking of those predictions, Ford shares ticked up 1.5% today. The major indices just could not swing it, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama will have much to say in his State of the Union address tomorrow night on the topic of jobs. He will say we need more of them, and he will probably say that he's going to spend a lot of money to try to make that happen. The White House is already on the record with some of its jobs promises. The president is spending millions of dollars to create green jobs, making homes more energy efficient. And not too long ago, he announced more than $2 billion in grants for clean tech manufacturing. But Sarah Varney from KQED reports that green jobs are not necessarily clean ones.
The pricey enclave of Piedmont, California, is an island of green in the Oakland Hills. Driveways are filled with Priuses, roofs topped with sparkling solar panels. And everyone, it seems, is cleaning out their attic.
As you can see, the insulation is moving out to the 6-inch hose. and going to a bag, a special bag designed for removing insulation because...
Devir Braca, co-owner of Advanced Home Energy, stands next to a house that's in the midst of a green cleanse. Two of his workers, wearing white plastic suits, booties, goggles, and respirators, are vacuuming out decades worth of dust, insulation, even mice droppings. After they're done, the workers here will pump in new insulation made from recycled blue jeans. Mike Wilson directs UC Berkeley's Center for Green Chemistry.
These are dirty jobs. They are often conducted in confined spaces with high levels of dust and in many cases using adhesive materials that are volatile, that contain toxic substances.
This niche industry will likely grow, exposing more workers to hazards. Most states do mandate special procedures for removing asbestos and lead, but of the 80,000 chemicals used in commercial products, just a few hundred have been tested for their effects on human health. And the state and federal worker protection agencies don't have the staff to enforce even existing regulations.
You know, jobs in the green economy are embedded in that system. And there is no doubt in my mind that we are going to see worker exposures and lack of compliance by employers simply because the enforcement mechanisms are so weak.
Green industry trade groups are keenly aware of worker safety. The number one cause of work-related deaths is falls, and workers carrying heavy rooftop solar panels on pitched, slippery roofs have died falling off buildings and through skylights. Workers are supposed to wear harnesses and other protective gear, says Sue Catley, executive director of CalSEA, a solar company trade association.
I've had constant problems with people telling me that construction workers don't like wearing harnesses on the roofs because it's not manly. And I'm saying, well, you know, wear them anyway. It's almost you feel like it's working with people when they first had to learn how to put their kids in child seats.
We're trying to get rid of that attitude, the macho, oh, I don't have to put gloves on to do this. I'll just do it like this. Or I don't need to put my respirator on.
Sylvester Hodges runs a green training program in a poor Oakland neighborhood where his students learn carpentry skills and the values that started the green revolution in the first place. Still, there's a long way to go. Even greener materials, like the recycled blue jeans used to insulate attics, are routinely sprayed with flame retardants. There are some less toxic flame retardants, but the most commonly used accumulate in everything from human breast milk to shellfish. In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Varney for Marketplace.
Four years ago, Howard Stern signed a $500 million contract to host a radio show. That was after Stern got sick and tired of dealing with FCC rules about what you can and cannot say on the air. His deal with what was then known as Sirius Satellite Radio expires at the end of this year, and there is talk today that Stern may be returning to the regular old broadcast airwaves. While he was gone, though, things kind of changed. Sirius merged with its rival XM, and people stopped buying satellite radios and all those pricey subscriptions, too. From Washington, Brett Neely reports.
On his show last week, Stern said he was getting offers to move back to the FM dial. The next day, radio giant Clear Channel said it would love to have Stern on its airwaves. But this week, on his uncensored satellite radio show, Stern said he gets offers all the time.
And I always say the same thing. No interest. I don't give a...
Stern's flirtation with Clear Channel comes as his contract with Sirius XM enters its last year. Negotiations to renew are going to be tough, says media analyst Bishop Cheen at Wells Fargo. Though Stern brought nearly 3 million listeners with him when he moved to satellite radio 4 years ago, he says lately Sirius has been bleeding red ink.
Sirius is faced with some serious budget cutting.
That means Stern isn't likely to get the same kind of salary either at Sirius or Clear Channel. Neither would comment. But Cheen says even if Clear Channel offers more money than Sirius, its offer probably won't be anywhere close to his $500 million deal. The commercial radio business has also suffered during the recession.
At the end of the day, if Howard ends up with a contract that's, I don't know, half of his current contract, he's still doing quite well.
Stern seems happy enough on Sirius. On his show, he said he wouldn't go back to regular radio, regardless of how much he's paid.
But I don't care. I don't want to be censored when I do a show. I want to be paid.
But being uncensored could cost him. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Coming up, the meeting to save the world.
One of the reasons our world hasn't collapsed quite in the way that it did in the first half of the 20th century is that people just keep talking.
We will have a preview of the World Economic Forum coming up in Davos. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials ended flat today. It shaved off just 2 points, closed at 10,194. The NASDAQ lost 7 points, about a 3rd percent, finished at 2203. The S&P 500 ticked down 4 points, a 3rd percent, ended the day at 1,092. Financial institutions helped push the market down. Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup all lost about 2.5%. J.P. Morgan gave back 2% today. Bank of America and Morgan Stanley retreated roughly 1.5%. Apple is slated to make a big announcement tomorrow, but shares rose 1.5% today based on quarterly profits from its existing products. That would be iPhones and Mac computers. Barnes & Noble jumped 13% on rumors that Apple's tablet reader will include an electronic Barnes & Noble bookstore. We'll see about that tomorrow, one hopes. Bonds were mostly flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.61%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information is at massmutual.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of December. The Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on cybersecurity. And President Obama delivers his State of the Union speech at 9 p.m. Eastern. No TV? It's also available via the new White House app. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Melamine is back in the news. Chinese officials announced this week they are still pulling contaminated dairy products off store shelves. It has been almost 2 years now since the original scandal, which came amid a swarm of high-profile problems with Chinese exports. Corruption problems inside one of the world's fastest-growing economies don't seem to be slowing down at all. And our China correspondent Scott Tong is on the line now to tell us more about that. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
So corruption we all know about. Give us some sense, though, of the scale of how big it is.
It's definitely getting worse. So what are we talking about? Well, we have this nice broad sampling of scandals that are going on in China right now. We have the white-collar model. If you think of the top executives at the Chinese equivalent of Best Buy or Verizon Mobile, you know, one is the former richest guy in China, and he's being investigated for stock price manipulation. The other just got canned for allegedly falsifying earnings, $3 billion in earnings. So you have that. And then you have the Chicago mob model. And next week, the top judge in the city of Chongqing goes on trial. You've been there, right, Kai?
Yeah, you bet.
Well, he is linked to this complicated web of businessmen, cops, mobsters, the transportation syndicate, illegal gambling dens, prostitution. Part of this huge investigation that goes to the center of the Communist Party leadership in Chongqing. So add it all up, there are more cases this year, higher-level cadres, higher-level business leaders than ever before.
Is it possible, though, that as the Chinese leadership recognizes its role on the world stage and the size of its economy, that they're just getting better at finding the bad guys?
That's the other way to look at this, that there's more sunlight and it's shining on a whole lot more of what's always happened in China. It is a top priority of the Chinese president, Hu Jintao, and they at least have to give the perception that they're going after this. If a yardstick is the snarky taxi driver in China, I mean, one driver in Yunnan province, which is clear on the other side of China, told me that the rich and powerful business types and bureaucrats, they're as bad as the old emperors of China ever were.
Give me your personal perspective, though, Scott. I mean, you've been there 3 years. Do you have people, like, slipping you envelopes full of cash and stuff?
One instance of the envelope.
Seriously? I was kidding, actually.
I did a press conference by a by a particular American profit-making institution that I'm not going to name.
Wow.
Checked in the press conference and got the press kit in return in an envelope with 200 RMB in it, which is about 25 bucks inside. And every journalist gets that. I didn't even know it was happening until I saw it and, you know, decided we probably need to give it back. But not an uncommon thing in China as far as a relationship with journalists. I mean, there is a widespread sense that the standard rules are for the people who aren't well-connected.
Do you have any sense, though, Scott, that all of this corruption can do actual damage to the China story as we know it?
Depends who you talk to, Kai. I mean, the folks who think this train is going to derail say this is a systemic problem that shows that the system is just rotten to the core. They argue there's no accountability in China for these things in the form of independent courts, free and open news media, opposition parties. And this is going to not just affect China, but the rest of us. Now, the other side says, look at this. This corruption issue has not slowed down this economic story. It has not stopped the foreign investors from coming in. Last time we checked, China was growing at 8.7% annually. And these are just rules of the China game, and basically everybody understands those rules. Law professor Jacques Delisle at Penn put it this way: a whole lot of people have shorted China and lost a whole lot of money. So a lot of the smart money thinks it's just going to keep on going, and this is the Chinese model.
Scott Tong in Shanghai. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Thank you, Kai.
The weather forecast for Davos, Switzerland this week is a chance of snow and no small amount of hot air. The World Economic Forum will be taking over the tiny alpine ski town starting tomorrow. More than 2,500 people, top politicians and corporate executives alike, are going to be there discussing how to fix the global economy. Our European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is in Davos this week as well, and we asked him to find out what attendees and observers might expect.
As presidents, prime ministers, and billionaires arrive in Davos, a pair of locals are laying on a traditional Swiss welcome. Dirk Schneider and Andy Recht are limbering up on a couple of 20-foot Alpen horns. Cattle herders once used this instrument to call in their cows from the mountainside. Now musicians like Andy and Dirk use them to entertain the tourists.
You don't hear it everywhere, and that makes it so special, so individual.
You need to have plenty of wind to play this instrument.
Yes, you do, definitely. You need to have a lot of wind, yes.
Cynics might say the same about the summit held every year in Davos. It's a huge talking shop, a massive gab fest for the rich and powerful.
This is a new world. But actually, we've been taught a very old lesson, which is that values matter.
That's former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair at Davos last year. Every January, the small alpine retreat is heaving with Russian oil tycoons, Chinese billionaires, head honchos from the US and Europe. Just being here is a heady experience, says Lord Digby Jones, a former British trade minister.
You can be in a reception and Bill Gates is the other side of the room. And Warren Buffett's over there, and it's a great ego massager. You feel that you're important.
All the leaders of the group of 20 nations are invited, though not all attend. Media chiefs and certain academics are invited too, and there's a sprinkling of movie stars. Yes, a bit of a celebrity fest, but, says Oxford University professor Tim Garton-Ash, worthwhile all the same.
The conference centre for 4 days is a hive of networking. Quite a good thing, I think. Better that the leaders of the world should get to know each other than that they don't.
Davos enthusiasts claim these annual gatherings helped the former communist countries of Eastern Europe move to capitalism and helped ease China's emergence as a major economy. Martin Wolf of the Financial Times says contacts forged at Davos may well have helped us weather the current economic crisis.
I think one of the reasons our world hasn't collapsed quite in the way that it did in the first half of the 20th century is that people just keep talking. I happen to believe that talking is quite a good thing to do.
The theme of this year's seminars and discussions is Rethink, Redesign and Rebuild. It will tackle issues like how do we avoid the next crisis? How do we reform global institutions like the International Monetary Fund? How do we deal with China? How do we improve the state of the world? But these issues may not be uppermost in the minds of some of the summiteers.
I did go there with the intent of helping the world, yeah, but my first priority was kind of to help myself.
Evan Newmark, now a columnist with the Wall Street Journal, has been to Davos as a businessman. Business pays for the forum. While politicians, media chiefs, and academics attend for free, business delegates pay around $60,000 each. Worth every cent, says Evan.
It was just a great place to meet and greet clients or potential clients, so it was a place to do business. If you asked me how much did I contribute to improving the state of the world, I'm afraid my scorecard may be pretty empty.
Critics of Davos say the summit has self-interest at its core. This year, the summiteers are under pressure as never before to prove the critics wrong and to answer the question, how do we really improve the state of the world? In Davos, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The elite at this year's Davos conference are being told to keep their limos and Hummers outside the village walls. Find out why on our daily Davos blog. Our homepage is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, picking up on the conversation I had with John Dimsdale earlier in the show about the president's proposed spending freeze. Candidate Obama, it seems, was against him before he was for him. Here he is in his first debate with John McCain last fall, also his second debate and his third.
Well, the problem with spending freeze is you're using a hatchet where you need a scalpel.
That's using a hatchet to cut the federal budget. I want to use a scalpel. So
an across-the-board spending freeze is a hatchet, and we do need a scalpel.
State of the Union, tomorrow night, 9 o'clock, Washington time. And with that, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow is pretty much flat, shaved off 2 points, closed at 10,194. The NASDAQ off 7 points, a third of 1%, finished at 2203. The S&P 500 ticked down 4 points, a third of 1%, ended at 1,092. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod B. They will have more from Davos in the morning, as will we tomorrow afternoon. And elsewhere on this broadcast, organizing jobs that cannot be outsourced.
Security workers have to be here. They're not going to be someplace else. Building cleaners are going to be here. Apartment workers are going to be here.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.